The following program is brought to you by Total Theater Online. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the staff or management of WGBB. You're listening to the station that serves your community, 1240 WGBB. And now it's time for Dave's Gone By with David Lefkowitz.
Well, there goes the neighborhood. Happy almost Passover, everybody, and welcome to the 124th edition of Dave's Gone By, hosted by yours truly, Dave Lefkowitz, radio personality, theater critic, journalist, and humorist, bringing you smart talk, silly talk, special talk, and music here on this Thursday night, April 21st, 2005, on AM 1240 WGBB, and live streaming on the web at am1240wgbb.com. Why is this night different from last Thursday night? Well, for one thing, we're actually here. There was a mail screw-up. Actually, a UPS oops last week. And so the new edition of Days Gone By that I was going to bring you last week did not air. It wasn't the station's fault, and they were kind enough to play a repeat of an old program as well as a rerun of Filler Up later in the evening. What happened was, I put last week's program together at home on my own little system, and I sent it overnight to the station for airplay last Thursday evening. And I've done this before. When I don't come to the station in person, I finish the show one or two days in advance and ship it UPS to Babylon, where the studios of WGBB are located. This usually works fine, but guess what? It's not FedEx, and it absolutely positively is not guaranteed to get there overnight. So I've kind of been playing roulette on that, and have been lucky up to that point whenever I was sending in a pre-recorded show for airplay. But last week, I came up 13 red, or whatever number is considered unlucky in roulette, and so episode number 123, though completed and packaged and absolutely adorable, never made it to the portals of Route 109, or at least in time for the show. It got there on Friday, thank you very much. So I may hold that show for a week when I'm out of town or under the weather and play it then. It was mostly the news gone by. A lot of funny news stories that, of course, will be stale as hell by then, but perhaps a nostalgia factor will kick in and the show will be enjoyable anyway. The lucky part, and I am very grateful about this, is that the glitch didn't affect the program with any guests on it. And we've been having a lot of visitors to the neighborhood the past several weeks. People like the Ubin twins, who directed Derailroaded, the Wild Man Fisher documentary. Also visiting were author Larry Quachi, who wrote the book A Very Good Year about his teen years growing up on Long Island. And talk about prescient. Part of the book tells of his coping with his mother's cancer and her begging him to help her die because she can no longer stand living anymore. And of course, the week after Larry was on, the whole Terry Schiavo thing exploded. Plus, he had people worrying the Pope would be in the same condition. So we couldn't have chosen a more propitious time to have Larry on. And 2 weeks ago, on Dave's Gone By, we welcomed the band His Mighty Robot just in time for the release of their four-song EP. So by sheer good fortune, none of these episodes was preempted or lost or waylaid. Sorry, don't want to anger the FCC. Way intercourse. And we have more guests coming up. In fact, I still can't get over that in early May, visiting the neighborhood all the way from England will be Reckless Eric, the new wave legend still making his own kind of music. But before that, this week and next, we've got a very cool thing going on. Three guests in two nights, all connected to the same event. Now, let me tell you how this came about. One of my other jobs, besides doing this radio show, because, you know, this program has made me so rich and successful, I can dally in all sorts of other career choices. Like, I'm sure one day I'll wind up a Burger King dilettante, or possibly a men's room attendant wannabe. But, no, I'm doing okay. And I am a writer and editor by trade, and a theater critic. Been doing that since 1988. And over the years, I've written for everything from Backstage to Show Business to The Manhattan Resident to Culture Finder. The past 2 years, I've been reviewing for New York Theater News, a little journal put out by the people who publish London Theater News. And just recently, I've begun doing pieces for Long Island Press, You've seen that newspaper. It comes out once a week, and it's available free in kiosks at various railroad stations and businesses. Looks a bit like the New York Press, although they're totally unconnected, not by the same company and not espousing the same political view. Actually, I don't even know what the New York Press's political view is anymore. They're going through brutal times over there. I mean, they were always too right-wing for me, but they were funky and had good stuff to read. And if nothing else, they had Mr. Wiggles, a comic strip about a vicious, psychotic teddy bear. Enough said. And Mr. Wiggles is still there, but they had a management change a couple years back, which shook things up. And then 2 months ago, they published a piece. It was supposed to be funny. It wasn't very. And here was the title, 52 Funniest Things About the Upcoming Death of the Pope. I kid you not, they really went out on a limb. And I can see sort of why they published it, because the author is Matt Taibbi, and he has done some superb work for them. And the piece was mean-spirited, very sick humor, and wasn't even taking pot shots at the backward policies of the Catholic Church. Nothing on abortion, nothing on birth control or homosexuality, no. It was just making fun of John Paul and what was going to happen to his corpse. I mean, I am unshockable, and I found it shocking. And you can still read the story online at newyorkpress.com. Look under, I guess, Taibbi or Pope. So, yes, the New York Press editors had this article. They deemed it permissible satire and decided to run it. I guess they thought that any kind of piece denigrating his eminence would serve a good purpose, just to counteract the two-week funeral and all the unquestioning media hype that sanctified him as much as any College of Cardinals ever could. Okay, so the New York Press chose to highlight this corrosive bit of mostly unfunny satire on the front page with a big goofy drawing of the pontiff and that headline, 52 Funniest Things About the Upcoming Death of the Pope. What the editor, Jeff Coyen, could have been thinking, I don't know. But I hope he was thinking of retiring, because 2 weeks later he was out of there. And funnily enough, management says he was booted not for popping the Pope on the front cover, but because in the same issue, he ran a parody of a New York Post cover without clearing it with legal first. Either way, much as I love a free press and a free New York press, I can see that story being over the line for a political alternative weekly, even for The Onion, though not, perhaps, for Hustler or Screw, sorry, Intercourse, or maybe National Lampoon, if they still had the cojones. But anyway, even before the John Paul jumble, New York Press was kind of all over the place in its approach and politics. I mean, Taibbi himself had been hammering the Bush administration, certainly not something that Mugger and the other press dinosaurs were wont to do back in the day. And so, all that digression, just to say, and that's why I love this show, because I can digress, regress, progress, undress, it is radio, and then go back to my theme, which was, the New York Press, which is not the Long Island Press, which I write for, and which does resemble the New York Press physically, and in the way it covers politics and social issues, followed by an art section, followed by a tiny sports section, followed by 30 pages of phone sex ads. And I've done a couple of reviews for the Long Island Press. I wrote about Brooklyn Boy, a production of Endgame at Classic Stage Company off-Broadway, and most recently, Spamalot, which got a decided, but not ecstatic, thumbs up. Anyway, Kenny Herzog, my editor at the paper, called and asked if I would do a feature. He had received a press release about a play opening out in California. A small theater in Los Angeles called Theater 40 was doing a dark comedy called Japanese Death Poem. Now, this would ordinarily be of absolutely no interest to a Manhattan paper, let alone a Long Island publication. But the author of the play, Danny Arcieri, is a hometown boy. He grew up around these parts and teaches at SUNY Farmingdale. And he's had plays done at Arena and Theater 3, as well as a couple of off-Broadway venues in the city. And 2 or 3 years ago, he submitted a one-act to Theater 40 in L.A. They did it in their festival, stayed in contact, and now they're staging his full-length play, Japanese Death Poem, playing now through May 22nd at Theater 40 on Moreno Drive in Beverly Hills. And so, the Long Island Press was intrigued by this Long Island writer who was suddenly getting recognition all the way on the other coast. And what was especially eyebrow-raising were the folks putting the show on. Theater 40 isn't a big Broadway-type theater or anything like that. Or even in L.A., it's not the Amundsen or the Mark Taper Forum or even the Odyssey. But it has a long and honorable history and some well-known names attached, including the director of Japanese Death Poem, Stephen Tobolowsky. Now, that is not necessarily a name you recognize off the bat. It's not like a $100 million action movie opens nationwide. And you ask, well, who's in it? And someone else replies, Harrison Ford, although they originally wanted Tom Cruise. And you say, what? They didn't get Stephen Tobolowsky? No, he's not that kind of name. But you would know his face, very likely, if you've seen films like Memento or the cable series Deadwood, or, most of all, the now classic Bill Murray film Groundhog Day. Tobolowsky played Ned Ryerson, the old high school friend and uber nerd who greets Phil every morning. Yeah, I think most of you are getting the image now. Well, Stephen is a theater director as well as an actor, and he was the one who flipped over Danny Arcieri's script and said, we have to do this at Theater 40. And it just so happens that when he first got the manuscript, Stephen was on Broadway for several weeks in a revival of Mornings at 7. One of his co-stars was the lovely and talented Julie Haggerty. Now, you know her from Airplane and A Midsummer Night's Sex Comedy and Lost in America and bunches more. Turns out, she was apparently perfect for a major role in Death Poem. And that's how these confluences happen. Long Island playwright Danny Arcieri gets his play, Japanese Death Poem, produced in Los Angeles, directed by Stephen Tobolowsky, and starring Julie Haggerty. Lucky fella. But he's not the only lucky one, because here on Dave's Gone By, we are hitting the trifecta. In researching my article for Long Island Press, I got to talk to all three of these folks. And before I did, I said to myself, wait a minute, these are some very cool people. It's a Long Island story. Why not put the interviews on the air, do them for the show, and then use the best quotes for the story? And Kenny Herzog, my editor, said, sure, just as long as the story runs first or simultaneously, so we get the jump. We agreed, and so my feature story on Danny Arcieri is scheduled to run this week in the Long Island Press. Look for it around your town, or if you give it a couple more days, the story, I'm sure, will be posted at longislandpress.com. In fact, if you do a search on my last name, Lefkowitz, you can see all the reviews I've written there as well, longislandpress.com. And so we've got this mutual cross-promotion going on. I'm telling you about the paper to read the article. The paper is telling people to listen to Days Gone By to hear all the interviews. And that, as I said, is the backstory behind this week and next. All three of these cool people involved with Japanese Death Poem, Stephen Tobolowsky, Julie Haggerty, and Danny Arcieri, will have a long chat with Danny next week. But this week, the director and the actress. Going to be a lot of fun, so stay tuned now from 8 o'clock on Dave's Gone By, which is brought to you by Hewlett Minuteman Press, 1315 Broadway in Hewlett on the South Shore. For all your copying, printing, and other business needs, Minuteman. We're also sponsored by Total Theater, publishers of Performing Arts Insider Theater Magazine. And we're talking about L.A. theater tonight. But if you want to know all about Broadway and off, Performing Arts Insider is the magazine for you. Find out more at PerformingArtsInsider.com. And if this is your first time listening to the program, give a look to DavesGoneBy.com, which has pictures, schedules, song lyrics, all sorts of things worth savoring and beavering. DavesGoneBy.com, the official website of Dave's Gone By, which is rated DGB-13, just in case we have content unbecoming, although I think it's safe to say tonight's episode is pretty DGBG across the board. We'll be hanging with Haggerty and talking with Tobolowsky when we come back, FCC, when we ejaculate back right after this.
I hate my family. The holidays came and went, and I didn't get a satellite radio.
Oh, who cares? You've got more than enough cool radio to listen to on WGBB.
Well, sure. There's Dave's Gone By, Thursday nights at 7, but what else?
Shh, calm down. Right after Dave, there's the instrumental invasion of smooth jazz, hosted by Mike Shimeri at 8, and then Dave comes back at 9 on Thursdays with Thriller Up.
Well, that's okay.
Of course it's okay. Plus, you've got radio psychic Joyce Keller doing her thing Wednesday nights at 11.
Oh, man, she's been on for years.
That's right. And you can listen to another WGBB veteran, Bonnie D. Graham, talking about the single life on Long Island's Dating Friday nights at 6.
What about comedy? I like comedy.
How about Mikey and Jimmy? Comedy, hard rock music, and live bands in the studio. And you can also get a few laughs about serious topics like news and politics on Your World with Joe Salzone, Sunday nights at 7.
Let me get this straight. Joyce Keller, the psychotic.
Psychic.
Wednesday nights at 11. Mikey and Jimmy, the funny. Fridays at 6 is Long Island's Dating. You think Bonnie can hook me up?
No.
Sundays at 7 is Joe Salzone. Thursday nights it's you at 7. Mike Shimeri at 8. And you again at 9. Did I get it all?
Nice job.
I don't need a satellite at all.
That's right.
That's good. I read somewhere the ultraphonic waves would interfere with the space aliens in my head.
Why do they always come to me?
Hey, this is Stephen Tobolowsky, and you're listening to Dave's Gone By on GBB.
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By, and time for my chat with actor and director Stephen Tobolowsky, who's staging Japanese Death Poem in L.A. Stephen, you there?
I'm right here.
Great to hear from you. Thanks for calling in. Let's get right to the play then. How's that going? How's Japanese Death Poem doing?
Oh, it's fantastic. I could tell you a little bit about the genesis, how I came in contact with Japanese Death Poem.
Sure.
Because a lot of people in New York may have seen me in Mornings at 7 when I was there on Broadway a couple years ago.
That was, by the way, a wonderful revival. It was a lovely piece.
Thank you so much. And Dan, I had directed Danny's, one of his earlier plays, Norman, at Theater 40, and it was an enormous success. Audiences loved it. We even had repeat business, which is what you don't usually get in theater. You get it in movies sometimes, but rarely do people come to see a play more than once. But they came to see Norman more than once.
Wow.
And when I've always been a fan of Danny's writing. Danny's writing kind of creates a perfect storm of entertainment and content. Not only are the plays emotionally true, they're scientifically interesting because of Danny's scientific background, but they're also funny, and that's a real rarity. A lot of times when people have a lot of emotional content in their plays, there's no entertainment value. So I was doing Mornings at 7, and Danny gave me a copy of his new play, Japanese Death Poem, which, in spite of the title, is also a comedy.
Mm-hmm.
In a true sense of the word, not only is it funny, but at the end of the play, a la classic comedy, your soul feels elevated.
Wow.
It is something. I started reading this play, and I got to admit, when I first got a play called Japanese Death Poem, one of the last things I wanted to do was read it while I was doing a comedy at night. But I picked it up reluctantly. I started reading it, and it was funny. And I was going, oh, my goodness. Danny didn't warn me that it was a comedy. So I'm reading it, and it's very funny. And I remember I got halfway through the play, and I called my wife in Los Angeles. And I said, honey, I'm reading Danny's new play, and I think it could be really great. I'm not sure, though. I'm not to the end. I'm only halfway through, but it could be really great.
Uh-huh.
She said, well, call me and let me know how it's going. So I called her about three-quarters the way through. I said, okay, this play is quite seriously good. It better have a good ending, or I'm going to be so mad because this play is so good. It got to the end, and I was bawling.
Oh.
I was in tears. It was so moving. It was so powerful. It was so eloquent. I threw that play on the floor. I called up Danny right away, and I said, it's brilliant, 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 brilliant. We got to do it, got to do it, got to do it. Now, of course, that was only, what, like 2 years ago.
Now, that's actually a relatively short process these days, but yeah.
It is always difficult to get things going. Theater 40, that had such a big hit with Danny's first play, was reluctant at first to do Japanese Death Poem, because they were afraid the title would scare people away.
Well, I was telling in my interview with Danny, I mentioned the whole thing that one of my professors at NYU, when I was taking writing there, was Tad Mazzell, who had wrote a lot for television in the 1950s, and he had won the Pulitzer Prize for a play called All the Way Home, which was an adaptation of A Death in the Family.
Right.
And that was one of the things. The producers would not, in the remotest way, keep the title Death in the Family because they were so scared of the word death. And, you know, going on a marquee, they figured that's it. There's no way. And, of course, if the critics don't love the play, then you're stuck with all the puns they're going to make on the title, too.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. I never even thought of that.
But Death of a Salesman notwithstanding, you would figure that kind of broke the curse.
Death of a Salesman not only is a very serious play, but even involves suicide. So it's pretty grisly, the subject matter. You wouldn't expect, and of course so is All the Way Home,
right.
Pretty grisly too. But Japanese Death Poem is amazing in a lot of different ways. But of course, what we did when we did a reading at the New Plays Festival in Dallas, Texas, at a Kitchen Dog Theater, which is one of the best theaters in Dallas, with an exemplary cast. I mean, just beautiful actors. That I added at the beginning, I directed in a very kind of stylistic Japanese way, very, I guess you would say, I guess modern theater goers would identify, if I said, a Brechtian fashion, very presentational, that I begin with someone almost narrating the play saying, Japanese Death Poem, a comedy by D.T. Arcieri.
Hmm.
And the audience immediately started laughing. Which was great.
Well, that even goes back to the old the story about the Sondheim musical Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. When they opened with Love is in the Air, you know, the reaction was like, oh, it's all right. And when they changed the opening number to Comedy Tonight, it became a smash.
I never heard that story.
Pulling the audience in, yeah.
Totally. What a great story. That is exactly the point. You bring him in immediately to understand this is the framework of the world we're going to be in. We're going to be very presentational. We're going to have a lot of structure because what I told Danny and what I think we're using in the advertisement is this play is about sex, lies, and poetry.
Hmm.
And poetry is enormously structured in a way as are human relationships. I mean, human beings think that we're creatures of change. But we're not. We're creatures of habit.
Oh, totally.
And that's the whole idea behind monogamy. That's the whole idea behind a marriage, whether a Jewish wedding where you step on the glass or where you say those words for better or for worse. They have age-old implications. There's tradition, which is also true with a poetry teacher in Japanese Death Poem kind of reciting, you know, various poems throughout the play. An interesting facet of the play, for the play to work, Nathan, who is the teacher, the poetry teacher in the play, the character, has to instruct the audience through the course of the play the essence of Japanese poetry, the style, and what a Japanese death poem is. Because I assume pretty much the audience doesn't understand a lot about haiku.
Right.
And the ending is so powerful because the audience has been instructed as to what Japanese poetry is, which is amazing.
Let me ask, did you direct the stage reading at Kitchen Dog, or you just went to
see? Yes, I did.
Oh, okay. Now, having done that, what did you learn from doing that? What elements are you taking from that in this one, and what did you learn to change, or sort of, is it as stylized or less stylized now that you're doing the full production of it in L.A.?
I think it taught me that the more stylized, the better, and it made me even put more stage direction into the play. We found that as a theatrical device, you know, you would read the play and it says, Jenny, that's the wife's name in the play, Jenny is dressed in pink, talking on her pink telephone in her pink kitchen. Well, I found that it worked, having a kind of symbolic kitchen, not having a real kitchen there at all, and having this narrating character hold up a piece of wood that's just painted pink behind Ginny's head. And just holds it up and says, Ginny is in her pink kitchen. And then he removes it. The scene goes on. The kitchen isn't really pink. But as an audience member, I still saw pink. I saw her sitting in a pink chair on a pink telephone without having to have a pink chair or pink telephone.
Well, that's theater. I mean, technically, even it's a cool idea to have that piece of wood. But even without the piece of wood, the audience should be able to go there. If the script is telling them so, if it's powerful enough.
And the stylized element of the color, if you remove color from the set, which is kind of what we did in Texas, then a little pink goes a long way. If you remove color, if you don't have a box set of like a kitchen and a doctor's office, but instead you just have a roller chair like you have in a doctor's office and an examining table, and that's it. And then you move that roller chair all over the stage, and it can become a different room. One chair can become the professor's office at school. It can become part of a psychiatrist's office. So it taught me less is more with this play. You want to have an empty stage, and you want to do it with symbolic set pieces and color, little bits of color, and as few little pieces as possible, and let the audience use their imagination. And it becomes really wonderful that way.
Well, you've been directing plays for how long now? I mean, when did you start going from the acting into the other side of it?
Well, I always have directed plays from when I was in college, even. I directed the premiere of the Miss Firecracker contest with Holly Hunter in New York.
Oh.
I directed the Lucky World premiere of The Lucky Spot in New York at the Manhattan Theater Club.
That's another Beth Henley play.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And out here in Los Angeles, I usually have time to direct maybe one play a year because the film and TV schedule is usually too busy. But it was more difficult to act in plays because that takes longer. But directing, I can act in a TV show or a movie and direct at the same time, and then I'm not required to be at the theater every night when it's being performed.
That's right. Once it opens, it's pretty much relatively frozen, and you can kind of walk away and just come and look at it now and then to make sure they haven't strayed too far from the initial conception.
I consider my job as a director to make sure all of us in the cast understand the story we're telling. And if you understand the story you're telling, there is less opportunity for the actors to stray. It's like, you know the story of Goldilocks and the Three Bears,
mm-hmm.
and I do too. And we could probably, you and I, alternate aspects of that story almost interchangeably right now, and we would end up with the baby bear. You know, we would know exactly where that story was going. Of course, when you're dealing with a world premiere, like we are with Japanese Death Poem, you don't have ages of having had the story told to find common ground. So it's my job as a director to read the script, look at it, work with the playwright so that we're both on the same page and we pass that torch to the actors and they know on a nightly basis what that common ground is and convey that to the audience.
I have to ask, do you have any experiences as a director that were sublime and also like your worst and nightmarish experience of directing?
I had many sublime moments as a director, one of which I directed a James Barry play, What Every Woman Knows, with my wife Anne, who's one of the finest actresses I've ever met.
Anne Tobolowsky, does she use her?
Anne Hearn is her name. And she was on Evening Shade with Burt Reynolds. She's in The Accused with Jodie Foster. She did ER. She's been in a lot of stuff. But
mm-hmm.
she's also won many of theater awards here in Los Angeles for playing like Elizabeth Proctor in The Crucible. She won a Best Actress award. She's really one of the finest actresses I've ever encountered. And I've always wanted to do this play for her. And it's a magnificent play, and we did it at Theater 40. And it was amazing to have people sitting in the theater wiping tears from their face at intermission, before intermission, and looking over at me going, this is the best thing I've ever seen in my life. And I go, wait till you see Act Two. And, you know, just to see an audience moved so much by a play. And also, another great experience, I did Our Town,
which
a lot of people hate to do because it's done in so many high schools. But I said, if you do Our Town right, with real actors and not with kids, it's a devastatingly powerful play. And I did it, and again, I had my wife Ann playing Mrs. Gibbs. And I remember opening night, the Variety reviewer was sitting next to me, and they were kind of jiving me kind of before, so are you nervous? And I go, no, I'm not nervous at all. And they go, why not? I go, because I've seen the play. I mean, we've rehearsed it. It's magnificent. It's a wonderful performance. You know, you're going to have a great time. I mean, there was no ifs, ands, or buts about it. At the end of the first act, the Variety performer looked at me, pupils in full dilation, just going, this is stunning. And I go, thank you very much. And they go, and who is that woman playing Mrs. Gibbs? I go, it is my wife. Now, in terms of nightmarish experience, my nightmare directing experience was I was called in to help a production that was having difficulty. It was at the Beverly Hills Playhouse, and it was a musical. And they asked me to come in and see if I could lend any directorial skills to pulling this show off.
Mm-hmm.
And so I sat down and watched the entire show, and they came up and said, do you have any recommendations? And I said, yes. The first recommendation, cut all the songs.
Yeah.
Not make it a musical. I said, I think, and they said, well, we already have the poster printed up. I said, well, it's good. Just put a red X through musical, brand new musical. Just cut. And I said, it'll be funny. I said, the play is funny, but the music doesn't work. And it seems that it's forever getting through each song, so let's just do the play as the play, and it'll be plenty long anyway, as it is. You know, we don't have to sit here for 3 hours and listen to a bunch of bad songs. So that was a pretty bad experience, and it's what do you call it? The composer and the librettist were a little disturbed, but the show turned out to be fairly successful after we cut out the music.
So they really took your advice and did it. Sometimes
yes,
they can't, you know, turn back and make that kind of decision. Now, as far as acting stuff, do you have a favorite performance or a favorite piece that you were in?
Well, certainly Mornings at 7 in New York was a wonderful time I had. And also I got to act with Julie Haggerty, which was wonderful. She played my girlfriend in that. And that's really where I met Julie, and that's where I thought she would be perfect for Japanese Death Poem. In terms of films, it's hard to beat Groundhog's Day. It's a, you know, I think time will show that'll be a classic film. Certainly a lovely performance by Bill, wonderful direction.
By Harold Ramis.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Just everything about it is a delightful comedy. It's really, really wonderful. So that's right up there. Certainly Memento is a terrific film, too. It was a great experience. And currently now Deadwood is a phenomenal experience to work on the show. Difficult, but phenomenal.
How much of a commitment does that require to be on a series like that?
Oh, Deadwood requires more commitment than most shows because they never have a script until the last second, and they never have a schedule. So, you know, I'd get calls at midnight or at 6:30 in the morning saying, like, we're going to need you in an hour. We're emailing you lines.
Are they allowed to do that union-wise? I mean, just call you when... Yeah. No, I thought it was like a 9-to-5 thing with an equity cut. You know, that kind of stuff.
No, I guess they are allowed to do that. And the results are pretty phenomenal. I mean, I feel like I'm in one of the greatest rep companies there is with Ian McShane and Powers Booth. I mean just the actors on that show, Tim Oliphant, you go down the line and they're just amazingly good.
Well, I want to thank you very, very much, Stephen Tobolowsky, for calling in. And again, I want to remind also people to see Japanese Death Poem if they happen to be on the West Coast. It's happening at Theater 40 in L.A. from April 16th to May. What's the closing date on that?
I think it closes at the end of May, even though there's already talk of extending it. I think we close the last weekend of May.
Thank you so much for talking to us in the neighborhood.
My pleasure.
I've been telling you for months why you should use Hewlett Minuteman Press for all your copying and printing needs. But here's one of the owners, Mike Toron, to tell you why.
Hi, how you doing? At Minuteman Press, our ultimate goal is service. We are your best source for the most complete line of printed products. You can check us out on the web at www.hewlett.minutemanpress.com.
What's playing on Broadway? I'll tell you what's playing on Broadway, and I'll do it by checking Performing Arts Insider. Off-Broadway, off-off-Broadway, off-off-off-Broadway. You keep adding offs, they'll keep adding listings. Who's in the cast? What's it about? Is it good? Can you bring the kids? Performing Arts Insider is the theater guide. Call 516-295-1511, 516-295-1511, or go to TotalTheater.com and click on Performing Arts Insider.
Did you know Dave Lefkowitz of Dave's Gone By is not just a radio personality? He's also a playwright, and his book, Marriage Babies and the End of the World, is filled with the same humor he brings to his show every week. Funny, sad, and true. At only $20 hardcover, $12 trade paperback, Marriage Babies and the End of the World makes a great gift. So get your copy today. Call 516-295-1511. That's 516-295-1511. Or email davesgoneby@aol.com.
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By on AM 1240 WGBB in Freeport, New York, and live streaming on the web at am1240wgbb.com. And we've been talking to a couple of guests involved in a play that's being done out in Los Angeles. It's called Japanese Death Poem, and don't turn off your radios right now. It's supposed to be quite funny and also sad and all those good kind of things plays are. And we're even lucky enough to be talking to the main actress in the piece. And if you haven't heard of Danny Arcieri yet, well, you probably will, because his plays are going to start getting done in New York more. And maybe you haven't even heard the name Stephen Tobolowsky, although you probably know his face, either from Deadwood or Groundhog Day or Memento. But I'll bet you know our current guest, and I'm not even going to tell you her name yet, because you're going to hear her voice, and you're going to know who it is. So, hello there.
Well, hello there, David.
How are you doing? Let's give people a chance to register the voice.
All right. Well, what should we talk about?
Well, let's talk about the play, first of all.
Oh, well, wonderful. Okay, well, the name of the poem, the play, as you said, is Japanese Death Poem, and I am just so excited to be in it with Stephen Tobolowsky and Gavin Glennon and David Hunt Stafford and Austin Peck and Scott Thatcher and Richard Miller and to work with this great playwright who this is the first time actually the play has been done as a production at Theater 40 in Los Angeles. This will be its first viewing. So,
were you in the stage reading at in Dallas or?
No, I was not. I read the play originally at Stephen Tobolowsky's home, and I wasn't able to go to Texas with him. So I But he had asked me to do this part, and he actually, Stephen and I were doing Mornings at 7 together in New York on Broadway, and that's where we met, and that's where he first read Japanese Death Poem, and he said, I think there's a play that we should do.
And, by the way, now I guess I can tell everybody, it's Julie Haggerty, if you haven't guessed from The Voice. And you're playing the wife of the professor, am I correct, in the piece?
Yes, and the wife of the professor, and then the professor has a brother, and who's a dermatologist,
mm-hmm.
and... I don't know. I hope that actually it's sort of like I actually don't want to talk too much about the play, although I do, but I hope that we'll get to come do it in New York and then it'll be a surprise for everyone.
Oh.
Because it does take a lot of twists and turns.
Yeah, I mean, Stephen had talked a bit about, you know, the stylistic staging of it, and also
right.
Danny had mentioned pretty much the plot of a love triangle and all that that's going on. But
oh, okay.
Well, it's cool, but we can also talk more about just how you've been doing and your career, both doing a lot of stage work and still doing the film work and a lot of TV as well.
Right, right. I started in theater a million years ago in New York. I lived in New York for 24 years, and I've been in California now for 10, and so I love theater. And I'm really thrilled to be working at Theater 40. It's this wonderful theater company, a true company. And I've become a member. And as we're doing our play, then Stephen's wife, Anne Hearn, is directing Driving Miss Daisy. So they'll be doing Driving Miss Daisy as we're doing Danny's Japanese Death Poem on opposite days. So they do wonderful work, and it's just this wonderful little space. It feels very much like a New York off Broadway theater. It's really special. So I actually feel like I'm very much at home in that theater.
So it was kind of like some of the off Broadway things that you didn't do that much off Broadway, but you were in a couple of things in New York over the years. I mean, I think I saw you in a Tom Noonan piece called.
Yes,
were you
wifey?
Or the wife,
yes,
yeah.
The wife with Wally Shawn and Karen and Tom, and that was off Broadway. And I started, my brother had a theater company, 35 years ago. It was called The Production Company, and that's where I started working when I was, let's see, I'm going to be 50, so.
Well, mazel tov. What was your first play?
My first play was at the production company, and it was called Mutual Benefit Life, written by Robert Patrick.
Oh, my gosh. I think he's still writing, isn't he? He's still
doing
pieces.
Yes, he is.
Yeah.
Yes, he is. And then the second play I did there was The House of Blue Leaves, which then many years later I did at Lincoln Center.
Were you Bunny or not? Or no?
I was Corinna Stroller, the deaf movie star.
Okay, cool.
Which was really fun. And I did it at the production company. I played that part, and then I played that part at the Lincoln Center, and then we moved it to Broadway.
At that point, you had made a commitment to be an actress. I mean, was that a natural decision to come to, or were you waitressing? I mean, what really gave you the impetus to do it full-time career?
I started working full-time as an actress when I was 21, doing off Broadway.
Right, but that isn't necessary. I mean, that implies a commitment to begin with, but unless you make it to a certain level, a lot of people drop out along the wayside or they can't afford to be actors
right.
and actresses.
Right.
So, but you were...
I have to say, I was so very lucky to be at my brother's theater company. He started the theater company, the production company, with five of his friends from Carnegie Mellon. He went to Carnegie. And I was very lucky because I was doing my second play there when Gretchen Rennell from Paramount saw me do the play and asked me to read for Airplane.
Oh, because it really came out of nowhere. It really was sort of like
right.
the film came and who is this person? And then America fell in love with you. I mean, it was just like the perfect person for the perfect role. And,
right.
you know, you must have beaten out some pretty well-known names, in fact.
Well, I don't know. I was very blessed. I have to say that, you know, I was very blessed that that happened, and that sort of really kind of took off. I did the movie, but I always, for 24 years, went back to New York because that was my home and would always do plays in between doing films.
Right. And then the question also is, you had that huge hit with Airplane, you did the sequel, and then there was this kind of, seems to be sort of a gap between them and when you got to do the Albert Brooks film, Lost in America.
Well, there was Midsummer Night's Sex Comedy that I did with Woody Allen.
Right.
And then there was Goodbye New York that I did.
Was that in between or were those sort of later? My time frame.
In between.
Oh, okay. Cool. So, well, I guess actually I have to break in and ask, any Woody Allen memories? Got to ask. Any thoughts on him as a director or working with him or his...
Well, he's a genius.
Well,
yeah. It was an honor to work with him. You know, a complete honor to be working, to work with him. I've been very, very fortunate, and I've had the opportunity to work with some rather brilliant people in my life that you know, I feel very, as I said, fortunate.
Well, I'm not looking for let's say, you know, negative or bad stories. I'm saying, like, the difference between doing a scene, say, with or for Woody Allen and a scene with or for Albert Brooks. I mean, what are their styles like? What's, you know, how does one work as opposed to the other?
Boy, that I can't say. It's just, every time I go to work, it's like you go, it's just different. You know, everybody has their own style. Everybody has their own way of working, and you know, it's so hard to say.
Okay. Well, what would you say then is the greatest stretch that you've ever had to do as an actress? Because we tend to see you in two different kinds of things. Especially early in your career, you were sort of the ingenue, naive, that role, and then I guess you get cast as a lot of sort of waspy John Guerry kind of people. Or not, I mean, John, who's the other guy? Gurney.
A.R. Gurney.
Right.
Uh-huh, Pete Gurney, yeah.
So, are there roles that you've done that really were totally the other side of the fence, and how did you work those?
Japanese Death Poem is certainly different from anything I've ever done, and The Wife.
Mm-hmm. In what way?
Well, I mean, she was pretty depressed. I mean, it was a pretty bleak character, you know, and very depressed.
How are you like in real life? You seem kind of lively and fun and not in that direction. That, I think, was one of the things about Airplane, that you seem to be genuine from the voice and everything else.
Uh-huh. No, I'm a happy soul.
You're a happy soul.
You know, I just enjoy life. It's pretty great to, you know, I feel very fortunate and blessed. And are you there?
I'm just listening.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So I just, you know, I have a wonderful husband and great stepchildren and great friends, and I get to, you know, I feel very blessed to get to do what I do for a living, and you know, what could be wrong, you know?
Are there roles either, well, I, again, talking theatrically, are there roles that you've always wanted to tackle and may or may not get the chance to?
Let's see. That's hard. There's so many coming to mind, and then you just go blank.
No problem. And do you, I assume you intend to keep on acting and performing for the foreseeable or whatever future.
Hey, why not?
Oh, well, yeah, it's a great life, of course.
It's wonderful. I've been doing it. I've been working as an actress for 27 years.
Wow.
So, you know, and as you get older and parts change and you meet new people and there are challenges and you always get butterflies and you're always terrified and then it's great and you know, it's wonderful.
And I assume theater remains and is your first love, but what about between film and TV? Do you have a preference?
No, I enjoy working. I really do enjoy working. It's two different ways that you approach work. I mean, one is with an audience, one is without, but there's just, I find joy in both mediums.
Here's a question. You mentioned that you've only been living in L.A. for about 10 years.
Yes.
I would have assumed that you would have been out there right after Airplane to, you know, be in L.A. where all the movies are. But you stayed in New York for a few more years.
Yes, I did. Well, New York was home to me, and I would come back and do theater, and then I got married to someone who lives here, and that's so, and then a whole new life. So, you know, I have great new friends, and my friends from New York, but I know Steven and, you know, all these great actors that I'm working with, and have, you know, so it's just,
so you totally
just make the world bigger. Yeah.
So I just want to remind folks that Julie Haggerty is appearing in Japanese Death Poem at Theater 40 in Los Angeles. It's playing from April 16th until, there's been a bit of scuttlebutt about this. I think it's till May 23rd, but there's also maybe rumblings already of an extension. I don't know if that's letting
the
cat out of the bag, but, well, yeah, if they're feeling strong about it, and obviously if it goes well, why not?
You know. Well, let's knock on wood.
There's a board here. I'll do it right now. Good, solid knock on wood. So, Julie, thank you so much.
Well, David, thank you, and it was just delightful talking with you, and come see the play. Well,
sure, fly me. I'd love to. Or bring it here, even better. That would be nice.
Yes, all right. Let's. We want to come do it in New York.
Sounds good. Sounds good.
Even better. All right, and let's just pretend and say that we will do it there, and then you'll come and you'll introduce yourself in person.
I would love to. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, David, and looking forward to meeting you in person.
Sounds good. These are the Daves, my friend, the perfect radio blend of comedy, talk, radio, and more. Yes, these are the Daves. More than 60 complete episodes of Daves Gone By, all on compact disc for your listening pleasure. Got a long drive home? Pop in a Dave. In the mood for a funny sketch or a fun interview, pop in a Dave. All CDs come in jewel cases with covers and photos and track listings, just $14 per CD, and that includes shipping and handling. Throw in another dollar, and I'll personally autograph the cover. If you're not sure which show to pick, just visit the Dave's Gone By website or email davesgoneby@aol.com and ask for the CD list. Audio cassettes are available, too, so start your collection today. These are the Daves, my friend. Makes a great gift to send. Give them a try if you love Daves Gone By.
If I were a rich man,
if I were a rich man, I could do the Daves Gone By show for years and years and never have to worry about money. But that's not the way things have worked out, so I need your help. You can help me by helping yourself by advertising or sponsoring segments on Daves Gone By. It's easy, it's cheap. Just go to davesgoneby.com and see the rate card, davesgoneby.com, and bring your message to my listeners and make us both rich.
Big, tall house with the room.
Is there anything better than an hour of Daves Gone By? Yes, more hours of Dave's Gone By. After you finish listening to the show on Thursday nights, surf your web over to dfsxradio.com and hear a vintage episode of Dave's Gone By every Thursday at 8. And if you miss that, they replay it at 11 Eastern Standard Time. So remember, hear Dave's Gone By Thursday nights at 7 on GBB, and then hear older episodes on dfsxradio.com at 8 and 11 every Thursday. It's all the Dave you could ever want! Kinda.
Hi, this is Julie Haggerty, and you're listening to Dave's Gone By, WGBB.
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By. Time for the quick thank yous. Thank you, Stephen Tobolowsky, directing Japanese Death Poem at Theater 40 in Beverly Hills, now through May 22nd. Thank you, Julie Haggerty, who's in the cast. I only wish you could have also heard the chat I had with her the week before setting up the interview. She was so freewheeling and fun and charming. What a sweetie. But
not as sweet as my beloved wife, Joyce, how do you get that in there, of all of you for tuning in every week. If you stay tuned to WGBB at 8, you'll hear Mike Shamiri's Instrumental Invasion, which is actually ending in 2 weeks. He's bringing the show to another station. At 9, I'll be back with Filler Up, an hour of eclectic music, and that is no exaggeration this week, when we play Roy Orbison, Iggy Pop, and Tchaikovsky. I guess Beethoven told him the news. And remember that you can hear vintage episodes of Dave's Gone By Thursday nights at 8 and 11 on the internet station DFSX Radio. Just go to davesgoneby.com and click from there. Before I go, I want to wish good luck to cabaret singer-songwriter Dottie Berman, our guest a few weeks back. Dottie's solo show at Don't Tell Mama, An Evening with Dottie Berman, is nominated for a MAC Award from the Manhattan Association of Cabarets and Clubs. The ceremony is this Monday at Symphony Space, so in the spirit of Passover, I'm keeping my fingers sexagonaled. And we will go out with a bouncy Passover song from an odd CD that folks at the radio station saved for me because I am their token Jewish concubine. It's called Let My People Go, a Jewish an African-American celebration of freedom, kind of tying in the Jewish exodus from Egypt with the black struggles against slavery and segregation. And it's half good, half a mighty wind, but a noble effort, and we'll close the show with an upbeat Moses number called Man Come Into Egypt. FCC. Man Shoots Sperm Into Egypt. Remember, next week on Dave's Gone By, Danny Arcieri, Thursday, April 28th, 7 p.m., until then, don't miss your days going by. This is Dave Lefkowitz. Good night. Let my pee-pee go. And gone by.
There is a man coming to Egypt, and Moses is his name. When he saw the grief upon us, in his heart there burned a flame. In his heart there burned a flame, O Lord. In his heart there burned a flame. When he saw the grief upon us, in his heart there burned a flame. There is a man come into Egypt. His eyes are filled with light. Like the sun come up in Egypt, he comes to drive away the night. Come to drive away the night, O Lord. Come to drive away the night. Like the sun come up in Egypt, he comes to drive away the night. There is a man.
There is a man
coming to Egypt.
He comes for you and me.
On his lips, a word is singing,
and the word is liberty.
Oh Lord,
and the word is liberty.
On his lips,
a word is singing,
and the word is liberty.
The souls of women and men.
We will follow him to freedom. Never wear those chains again. Never wear those chains again, O Lord. Never wear those chains again.
We will follow him to freedom.
Never wear those chains again. Never wear.